Welcome to Connectivity here at Nintendo World Report. I'm your host, Neil Ronahan. Joining me as always, John Raritan.
Howdy, everybody.
And joining me as, 2 weeks in a row, Alex DeFravis.
I am really feeling it, guys.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Get hyped. We're going to talk hardcore Xenoblade spoilers in the back half, but not about three. Almost literally right before recording, Alex beat Xenoblade 1.
Yep.
So stay tuned, potentially post-credits for some hot Xenoblade 1 spoiler talk. And then some, I don't know, I'm in Chapter 3 of Xenoblade 3. It's very good, but we'll save that for the end.
And you may be thinking to yourself, didn't Alex just, like, get past, you know, maybe, like, Chapter 6 or 7 in the last week's episode? Yes, that's correct. I no-lifed this game really hard. On casual mode, it was a lot easier.
It's been a long time since I've played a Xenoblade game in any way other than no life mode. It's just sort of you go in being like, I can play this at a rational pace. And then you're 20 hours into a weekend.
It's one of those things when I see some of the and I mean, not that I want to make anybody crunch a review, but I always chuckle when I see the stuff where it's like, I had to play this game like over. I had 3 days before embargo to play this 100 hour RPG. And then, like, that game comes out on a Friday and people are talking about the ending by, like, Saturday night.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, like, if the, for a sect of the audience, part of it is a game comes out. That's all you do for 3 days. That's just right. That is what people do. That's not how I play games anymore. Even if I've been, I mean, I think at this point about 20, 25 hours into Xenoblade 3 in the past week. And that's I got kids now, man. It's tough. Unless I got a deadline, it's going to be a little leisurely.
Yeah. It's the coward's way to play, but I accept it as long as you're playing.
Yeah. No, it's great. I love Xenoblade 3. It's awesome.
We're not going to talk about that right now.
Yeah. It's not crossed the Atlas line yet. It's incredible. But what we are going to talk about is something, I would say equally incredible, but there's a funny postscript to it. So Mario Kart 8 Deluxe DLC, the second wave hit last week. How we feeling? Two waves in. How are we feeling about the Mario Kart 8 Deluxe DLC, the Booster Course Pack?
I've got a fresh round of comments on my Mario Kart 8 DLC graphics video of people saying that I made them angry. So I'm feeling good. Lots of people who have no idea how the most basic elements of, like, 3D texture work and shit works, telling me that I'm wrong when I've done that shit in a professional capacity, but that's fine. But yeah, I good pack. I'm not honestly a huge fan of the sweet dream treat cake ice cream. What's the new level called?
It's honestly, I can't even remember. Whatever the one that is now in the deluxe DLC and
yes.
Tour. It's maybe one of the worst new tracks I've seen in Mario Kart.
It's kind of, yeah. Do you feel like the camera is almost aimed up the entire time? Like, I feel like I can never see where I'm going to land.
Yeah.
When I'm coming off of ramps, like, it, there's just something about, like, the camera positioning. And then even if the camera was in a good position, it's kind of just a boring track.
It is just a loop. It's kind of like worse Excitebike, because Excitebike is just about you go in a loop and you do tricks. And it's kind of just that, but maybe it's got anti-gravity now, and
assuming you play an 8,
it's worse.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess if you're playing Tour, it doesn't have anti-gravity, which means it doesn't really matter.
I think it plays better in 8 than in Tour, because in 8...
Every track plays better in 8 than
yeah,
Tour.
Yeah, it's fair. but in 8, like, those... In 8, it's like an anti-gravity track the whole way through. And the railings, as you're going up the steps at the beginning... You can hit those in anti-gravity and boost off of them, which doesn't make sense.
And in Tour, you just hit them head on.
Right. So I kept running into them when it got added, because I'm like, I gotta get a boost, and it's just kunk. It was weird to me that that was even a boost, as that's not normally how the boost works in the anti-gravity stages. But it makes it a more interesting stage, I think, in 8 than it is in Tour. But other than that, I thought all the stages, they continue to look great. I love the just high fidelity version of Tour's art style that these DLC tracks have.
Yeah.
I think Calamari Desert is a gorgeous track, and the fact that they make you Drive on the Railroad track is just so in tune with what everybody did as a kid in Mario Kart 64. And I love it.
Well, I mean, and that ties into some of the Tour tracks. I forget, I haven't looked to see like what the exact blending is, but so in Tour, they have like the alternate paths for some, it'll be like a variant course, or variant design for a course. And like the, I think it was the Paris one in the first wave, Calamari Desert does that too, which is kind of a fusion of a couple different runs.
Yeah, each lap is a different version of the track, which is great.
And I saw, I didn't notice this, but it makes sense, is I saw someone comment on your video about the fact that, like, if you lap someone, like, you will see them, like, going over a ramp that isn't there. which makes total sense as to why it would happen. It's just funny, because with Mario Kart Tour, you never have to worry about that.
Right. It's something that, like, it's not a, I'm pretty sure, like, if you play, like, Sonic and All-Stars Racing Transformed.
Yeah.
Where it does the same thing, where each lap, like, the track changes physically. You'll see the same thing if you leave a car sitting still and then you lap it. It'll be in a place that you cannot physically get to. But yeah, they did this round has a lot more of that. Like, there are most of the well, probably about half the tracks in it have those different paths for each lap. And not like, I like that it, because it's not just the, like, both of the city levels do that in this one, but then also like Calamari Desert, which is cool. And I feel like there's another one that does it, but I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I do like Mushroom Gorge and Waluigi Pinball, although Waluigi Pinball has been run into the ground for me because it's been so featured in Tour over the past 2-3 years. Mushroom Gorge is a relatively newer addition to the Tour rotation. And that was one that I just always loved the feel of, like, bouncing off the mushrooms on the Wii version. So glad to see that in 8.
It feels like the booster course kind of follows this, like, at least so far out of the two packs we've got, is the rhythm of a couple of the city courses from Tour, one, like, brand new track, even though Shy Guy Hideaway is not a brand new track that was in Tour beforehand, and then a couple of fan favorites, and then just like a crappy, like, GBA or SNES track.
Though honestly, the GBA track in this, they did a really nice job on the remaster of that.
I thought it was super boring, but
I just don't like the GBA courses.
It's a very simple track, but I like their interpretation of that better than the Super Nintendo course that they did, where they left it 100% flat. I like the little bit of, like, let's give it a little bit of verticality. It's still the same track as it was in GBA, but I think it's a nicer look. I like that better. Yeah. Especially, it feels weird with the Super Nintendo tracks when you already have Donut Plains in base Mario Kart 8, and it's, like, one of the most beautiful tracks in the game. And then you go to whatever Mario Circuit is in this DLC, and it's just completely flat. I don't know. I prefer doing a little bit more to kind of change up the topography of the flat tracks.
Yeah. So, yeah, looking forward to Wave 3. I guess, what if we're looking at this cadence? But it was like March and then July. So I guess look forward to November?
Yeah. I was hoping these would be at a slightly faster pace.
Maybe it'll quicken a little bit. Who knows?
So it's supposed to be, what, 2 years?
Yeah, I think, what, 48 tracks over 2 years?
Yeah, I think they have to speed up a little bit if they want to be done by the end of 2023.
Well, I think, I mean, if there's four, right? There's four more packs after this? Four more waves?
Wouldn't there be... gotta be six, right?
Six, yeah.
Oh, shit, is that it? Yeah, they're gonna have to quicken the pace.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got to move it right along. Though I didn't, so this is probably conspiracy-brained, but I did notice that the grass texture in this DLC pack is not the same as the grass texture they were using in the last round.
Ooh.
So they may have held it back to address the grass texture, which
that would be funny.
Might not be the case, but I think that's a possibility.
Yeah, maybe if there's like a September direct or something, maybe we'll see the third wave around then.
Mm-hmm.
In other Mario Kart news, I got to eat some Mario Kart cookies.
It's exciting.
They are Keebler Fudge Stripe cookies, Rocky Road, as it were. A mix of, I think it's like an almond chocolate cookie with some marshmallow frosting. Delicious. And I guess first off, disclosure, Keebler sent these to me. And they'll be in Walmart in like now, and then nationwide in other stores in mid-September. But here's a fun fact about me that I ignored for this. I have a mild allergy to tree nuts. And this is almonds in it. And I was like, oh, screw it, I'm gonna have these. And I noticed like a half an hour later, I was like, oh, my throat's a little scratchy. So the things I do.
Yeah.
Thankfully it is a mild allergy. And not a bad one. It was one of those things, like when I found out that I did have an allergy to tree nuts, it just made a lot of sense as to why I didn't like certain nuts. Because I don't think I ever processed that, like, oh, that's what an allergic reaction feels like. It was just more, I was like, oh, that tastes bad. But I could definitely tell that, like, it was a little bit, I was like, oh, yeah, that's irritating me a little bit. But it's cool stuff. Do you guys have any interest in some Mario Kart Keebler Fudge Stripe cookies?
Yeah, I mean, are you going to send me some, or?
I mean, like, the
pop
bag's
one in an
done.
Envelope.
My son and my wife had a good mess of them tonight as we played Mario Kart Uno, which Keebler also sent along.
Did you eat them in your Mercedes-Benz?
They
they didn't send a Mercedes-Benz, damn it.
Yeah, you really, really, like, buried the lead there. They did send you a surprising amount of things that weren't the cookies.
Yeah, which yeah. I got funny. Like the Halloween costume Mario hat and gloves. I also got a green shell plush of Mochi Mochi, which I actually do have. I think I have a video of that.
Yeah.
Where it's because I don't like showing pictures of my kids' faces, so it's like a picture of my son, my oldest son, when he was younger. With like, I think I just had like a smiley face over his face as he's with these plushes.
That is roughly what he looks like.
Yeah, no.
It's a decent approximation.
He's got two eyes. He's got a smile.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a frown depending on his mood. But I'll tell you, he was not. Well, he was frowning before having the cookie, but having the cookie helped him not be as upset. And then later on, he was fine because we were
hanging
out. I take
it he does not have a tree nut allergy.
Here's hoping. He's sleeping peacefully. We'll find out real soon. I do not believe he does. Considering that I think mine might have developed when I was older. So who knows? Mario Kart stuff. It's always wild, some of the licensing stuff that Nintendo does, that like there's certain games that you're like, I thought that was done. And it's like, oh, no, they got to hit the Lunchables crowd right now. Like, we already got you gamers. Now we're going to have Animal Crossing Lunchables in 2022 or something.
Listen, as a kid who would occasionally see Donkey Kong on a Lunchable would be like, well, I obviously need to eat that. Like, that marketing works.
The Pokemon cereal from the other year. And I got the Pokemon Oreos.
Yep. When I bought the Mario cereal.
Yeah.
Which granted was also an amiibo. So, you know, that was important. Yeah. But still.
I can look at my box right now, my Super Mario cereal that I can also offer up to Uncle Amiibo in game whenever the need arises.
The need has yet to arise, but you know, if it ever does, then
yeah. Now I don't even remember what amiibos do.
I'm pretty sure like that Roomba thing will tell you like, oh,
there's a moon,
there's
here.
A star or a moon or whatever in this level. You'd be like, I know, they're everywhere.
Yep.
That's what they should be doing with amiibo more, is just like putting it in random products.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you never know. So you just have to scan everything. Did you try scanning the cookies?
No, there is a platinum points, my Nintendo platinum points, but they do not work as amiibo, unfortunately.
That's too bad.
Wasn't there like a Kirby thing also recently?
Oh, there was the Kirby, the Kung Fu Tea. That we do have a written review from Justin Berube.
Okay.
And there was also some Cold Stone Creamery ice cream that I think there was an Animal Crossing one, a repeat Mario one, and a Kirby one. The Kirby one I think was very sugary,
as it should be. Kirby looks like a sugary guy.
Why don't they do like F-Zero merch and ice cream or Earthbound ice cream?
Because then
Earthbound ice cream would taste like shit.
the thing that finally kills ice cream would be F-Zero branding on it.
Yeah.
It stood for hundreds of years, but Captain Falcon took it out.
Kirby is an endearing, like, child franchise thing. Animal Crossing is huge, and Mario's eternally big, especially Mario Kart.
but somehow spandex man on the ice cream doesn't make
yeah,
it sell.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, like, I mean, it's generally like Mario branding. Like, you don't really see Zelda branding as much. I mean, that's also probably a demographics thing.
I'm a 30-year-old man and I eat ice cream. And I might eat more of it if Link was on it.
I would buy the shit out of, like, Legend of Ocarina. What would be the flavor for your Zelda ice cream?
I mean, if it's Link, then I would assume it's some sort of, like, peppermint for the green.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Maybe, like, a good mint chocolate chip.
Yeah.
With, like, I don't know, like, would it be, like, pretzel bits in there? Are we doing, like, a Ben & Jerry's Legend of Zelda-themed ice cream?
Trying pint? To think. It nuts. It'd be Deku nuts.
Yeah.
It would be like Neapolitan with like the three different colors are like the blue, red, and green of
like the spiritual the stones.
Yeah.
Have your people call my people Nintendo, and we'll help brainstorm some Zelda branding, some Zelda licensing for Breath of the Wild too. Let's go.
I mean, we have a cookie contact now.
Yeah.
I like that they send out review copies of cookies. I did not know that was a thing.
It was a cold call email. Although I guess for anybody that wants a little behind the scenes inside baseball, Keebler, I think it's the same PR company that Nintendo uses. Golan Harris.
They're in the same office.
Golan? Keebler has Golan for their PR company.
I mean, like Golan isn't like a nationally renowned PR firm. So does Lego.
That's why,
like,
it's incredible.
Yeah, Golan also, I think, has the Lego PR.
That makes sense.
They're the contact there. So it is always interesting. And I think in that case, because even like the Lego stuff where I think we got like press releases from the Golan people at Lego. I don't think they ever actually sent review copies. Although I did get a review copy of the Sonic the Hedgehog Lego from last year, but that wasn't even from Golan. I think that was from a different PR company. That's more like a threat than a... Yeah, they emailed me and I was like, I will do a... we'll make a Sonic Lego set and then write about it. That works. But yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the reason is probably that, like, Keebler was like, oh, we got this Mario Kart cookie, and then they probably talked to the Nintendo team and they're like, here's the dipshit that will cover it.
Was there any, like, embargo that you had to abide by?
No.
Okay, there weren't, like, parts of the cookie you couldn't discuss before a certain date?
No. I mean, that would be funny. It's like you can't reveal the ingredients or the calorie count until launch.
Only discuss the first two cookies in the package.
It is like one of those things where, like, it is a wild thing to cover because it, like, legitimately gave me an allergic reaction.
Yeah. Do you take points off?
You should write a very, very negative review.
You'd be like, by the way, if you have an allergy to tree nuts, don't.
Skip this entry in Keebler's cookies if you have allergy to tree nuts.
What you need to know before you eat Keebler cookies. 25-minute long lore video on Keebler cookies.
Yep.
Know your cookie products, like know your developers.
Yeah. I forget if Keebler is a garbage company. I know Nabisco is bad.
I mean, don't say they're a garbage company. They just sent you cookies. Granted, they tried to kill you, but, like, still, it was the thought that counts.
It's like the one. There's like one person who used to work at Nintendo that now works on like the Keebler team at Golan, and is like, we almost got that 7.5 out of 10 son of a bitch out. I was gonna put more legumes are fine, peanuts are fine.
It is specifically Mario Kart 8 branding, so that would kind of make sense. Can you write a review of these and give it a 7.5?
I thought about it
just to warm my heart.
By the time you listen to this, I'll probably have something up at the site about it. I'll cover more cookies. Let's go once again. Let's do the Zelda ice cream thing. I think it's a good idea.
It is the second. I mean, you've now covered both Crash Bandicoot and Mario-based cookie products.
I've done the Mario cereal in the past.
Yeah.
I leave Justin to the ones where, for some reason, Justin, a person who I think is one of the most insular people that I know when it comes to COVID, he has been the one to, like, go out and being like, I'm going to Cold Stone to try the Nintendo ice cream, and I'm here living like a fat cat, getting cookies mailed to me.
Justin, if you're listening to this, I'm pretty sure Cold Stone is on DoorDash. And I say pretty sure.
It'll melt.
But I know. Yeah, you just throw it in the freezer when it gets there for a few minutes and you're good. Not that I order ice cream delivered to my door on a disturbingly regular basis. But you know, there are ways to make it work.
On that note, let's talk about other things. Like, now we're in the month of Splatoon, even though Splatoon doesn't come in.
Oh, I mean, like, within 30 days.
Yeah, we are
of
within
Splatoon.
A month.
Got it.
Yeah, we are within a month. Okay. Splatoon comes out September 9th. We're recording this August 10th. Nintendo, they have a rhythm of doing these directs about a game a month before it comes out. It's almost like it's part of a marketing plan. But so the Splatoon 3 direct happened. Alex, what are your thoughts on Splatoon 3 after the direct?
I can't believe I paused playing Xenoblade for that direct. It was 30 minutes and it was everything that, like, it's everything that you expect out of a Splatoon game. And I think honestly, they may have screwed themselves over with that first reveal of Splatoon 3. Because yes. I think everybody, it was like resounding across all outlets. Everybody who's doing a reaction was like very excited for what this new.
It looked like Mad Max Splatoon.
Yes. And it looked like it was taking the series in a different direction. And that different direction is exactly the same shit we've seen with Splatoon 1 and 2. Like there's the same lobby, the same like plaza, the same kind of shops. I mean, there's a different shop runners. Some things are minutely different, but all the components are exactly the same. And it's turning out that Splatoon is more a platform rather than a franchise with individual series.
Like, okay, it did come out after the fact that if you have save data for Splatoon 2, depending on your rank, you won't have to, you can like just hop into anarchy battles right away or something like that. But like, it's not a platform. Your shit doesn't carry over. Like you're starting almost from scratch. Like they finally took baby steps into having stuff actually carry over. Whatever, like whether you played 20 hours in Splatoon 2 or 40 hours and had your Switch die and you lost it all, or you played 2,000 hours in Splatoon 2, it doesn't really matter when you get to Splatoon 3. It's a new game with minute tweaks to how the weapons work. There's some new weapon types. The modes probably all control just a little bit differently and have slightly different rules and variations. But it's not a platform. And that's the thing that frustrates me with what Nintendo's doing with Splatoon is that they're doing these releases. It's been 7 years since Splatoon 1 came out. And I remember the feeling when Splatoon 1 came out that it was this bold new IP from Nintendo. It's so exciting. Yeah. Think of the potential of this world, of this game.
Yeah.
And it's not that, like, Splatoon 2, very enjoyable game. I reviewed both of the games. I think I gave Splatoon 1 a 9 out of 10. I was very high on it, even though it didn't have a lot of maps at launch. I thought it was incredibly fun, greater than the sum of its parts at the time. And I think I gave Splatoon 2 an 8.5. Those were both very good games. Like, but there's diminishing returns in the fact that, like, I feel like they're just doing the same thing over and over again, but it's not a platform. This isn't a free-to-play game, even if Nintendo almost seems to pitch it like that.
Right. Yeah, I think Alex is right that it's like they're treating it like it's a platform, even though it does not have the infrastructure to actually be that.
It's a platform in a very Nintendo way, where like a usual platform game would be like, okay, it's a games as a service with like a battle pass, or there are expansions that release, you know, once a year that are like $20. No, this is a full new numbered entry for $60, and it's going to be supported for 2 years, and then they're probably going to repeat the cycle within 4 years of right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, it's an annual release that took 5 years to come out.
And I guess there's something to say about, like, at least it's not annual. Like, at least it's not, like, literally an annual release.
See, here's the thing. I think there would be an argument for if this was a game that came out annually, then I wouldn't be judging it so harshly, I think. You know, like, it's kind of because of the... And, like, Neil and I were talking about this earlier. Like, yes, this game didn't go into development as soon as Splatoon 2 came out or anything. Like, they, like, did other things in the meantime.
Yeah, they did. They did. I mean, to just roll through it, this team did updates for Splatoon 2. They did Octo Expansion. And I think some amount of, like, the wide... I think there's, like, a core Splatoon team that kind of has always been working on Splatoon, but I think some of the support staff probably worked on things like Animal Crossing.
But from the consumer optics standpoint, you look at this game and you, it's very hard to see 5 years of waiting in what they're pitching for this game. This is not to say that the content that's there is bad. Like, it's just as good as it always was. But, like, what is true? There's a card game, and there's a, what, like, there's a stingray that wears goggles. And, like, admittedly, yeah.
that really
just blows the doors wide open for Rule 34 possibilities farther than Splatoon has ever had before. But, like, that's not... I don't understand why... If I get a hankering to play Splatoon, like, I guess I'm going to go play the Octo expansion. Like, I don't see what is supposed to draw me into this game outside of just them saying we'll support it.
I do love the, like, looking at Nintendo's press release that they sent out with it, which has some things in it that just some of the phrasing of some of it is kind of part of the problem. Return of the Mammalians, the completely new story mode, is ideal for getting the hang of battles and weapons.
We know. We've played the game.
Yeah.
It sold very well. It sold well for a Wii U game.
Yeah. Like, sold well for a Switch game.
Yeah. And it's... The single player is a... So I respect that this is a multiplayer game first and foremost. But here's the thing. Nintendo keeps putting single player in this game, and they keep trying to tell a story in the single player in this game. So, like, clearly it has some value to them. But the single player continues to just be this series of challenge stages that have no context within the greater world, where you'll pick up these scrolls and things that tell you about the story of the game. And in those scrolls, you see pictures of things that look way cooler than what's happening in the story mode. Like, you see pictures of, you know, this is the turf war from 1,000 years ago. And it's like, it looks like a image from like World War II. And it's like, cool, let's do that, as opposed to this like off-brand Mario Sunshine bonus level. Like, there's a disconnect between what the game is telling you that you're doing, which is like fighting this war against whoever the hell, and then what you're actually doing, which is jumping between floating platforms in the middle of a void. Like, it just doesn't...
Which I remember... how cool that was in the first game, because it was,
I think it, I mean, was excusable in the first. I don't think I ever got like, I didn't really like it then either, but in the first game I respected that, like, okay, it's a multiplayer game, single player was probably an afterthought. Fair enough.
you were getting a feel for what that game was like. That's when they had like the bizarre two-player where like you would tie a Wii remote to a controller. Like, they actually said that
they
was
were
the experimenting,
they were hedging their bets.
Yeah.
But we're past that, and the single player hasn't changed at all. And I kind of feel like either get off your dick and make a real single player mode, or just stop. Like, if you don't want to do single player, fine, no problem. It's a multiplayer game. There are plenty of multiplayer games that are legitimately multiplayer only. And honestly, based on the reveals we've seen for Splatoon 3 so far, seems like you could use some extra development resources on your multiplayer. to maybe like add some more modes or like do something slightly different. So yeah, kill the single player or make a legitimate single player.
There isn't a new battle mode in this, is
no,
there?
It's no. Just Splatoon 2.
Yeah,
with four new maps.
I'm not sure if it's entirely like adequate to say that the single player doesn't deserve to exist in the way that it does. I know a lot of people love the Octo expansion, and I think the campaign can be fun, even if it's just a series of challenge levels. I certainly enjoyed, especially the first campaign, the Splatoon 1.
It was a breath of fresh air.
Yes, it was.
I don't know. I think if I went back to it now, it would not be as fun as it was in 2015. But I really enjoyed it, especially the boss battles were really cool and fun.
Yeah, and I think I was speaking with my brother, and like there are some things, and he's a lot more into the multiplayer than I am. And there are some things that they revealed, such as the kind of the new movement options for the squid when you're in squid mode.
You can do the squid roll.
Yeah, and that looks like it would be very like it would change up the gameplay a lot for when you're actually like in a multiplayer match. But if you're looking at like the broad content, it's all the exact same.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's what's upsetting. Like, I would really love to see a like an 8v8 turf war or something like that.
I was kind of excited when they did mention the three team Splatfest battles. And I was like, oh, like that's going to be like a 12 player match. And then it's like, nope, we just put one of the team on two different sides. Like, oh,
yeah.
Okay. Like, it's like even when they do something new, they somehow still manage to make it kind of just the same thing again. I'll give them credit for making Salmon Run playable at any time. It's almost like they intentionally gimped that feature from 2 so that they could have a free bonus in 3.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you any bonus points for that.
Yeah, like you just made a basic function of the game work. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Well done. Here's my $60.
Same with the matchmaking, which I hear, like, I think it might be a little bit better because you can just see who's playing and jump in. Like, that's...
Yeah,
that works nicely. That's one part. You know what? Let's go to the press release. The Splatsville lobby is host to a number of features. Online friends appear as 3D holograms. In battle, it's easy to join as an ally or drop in as an opponent. And by forming a team and playing, players can see what friends are up to at any given moment. The lobby also includes a memory player, which can replay recent battles. So it does seem like it'll be easier to hop in with a friend, at least do it in a more engaging manner, which, like, that could be neat. And that is, once again, that's a refinement that's not something wholly new, at least from what we can tell.
It's borderline a patch.
Yeah.
Like, it's refinement might be too generous. Like, that's something that should have been patched into the original game when we realized that it didn't work, not built an entire new game around being able to play a multiplayer game with other people.
Yeah, I remember when, like, Super Mario Party got online, like, several years later.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of these implementations could have been kind of like that. Or,
you could have just made Salmon Run work all the time in Splatoon 2.
That was a button that could have been pressed at any time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, if it was that easy, and I'm sure not all of it is that easy, but I'm just not impressed. But I still love Splatoon. And that's the part that's kind of like stressing me out.
Yes.
Do I want to, if I'm going to play this game, I know that the optimal time for me to play is like when it first comes out and everybody's kind of learning hyped together as a community and hyped and like actively engaged with it. But I'm also pretty bummed that this game looks kind of like the game that I already have installed on my Switch. That is still pretty good. I'm not sure why I would be jumping in other than for the zeitgeist and for the excitement of playing a new Splatoon. And I love Splatoon, so maybe I would use that as just an excuse to jump back in. But I'm also torn up because, like, I could be, you know, playing Wind Waker for the Zelda Game Club during that time.
Yeah, I have other things that I could play, and it's the...
You know what was, like, just as much of an upgrade over the previous version of the game? Wind Waker HD to Wind Waker is Splatoon 3 to Splatoon 2.
Yeah.
I will say, this is a little bit to dunk on the game, but also just to highlight what is actually new. I want to call out that I loved Salmon Run.
Best mode in the game.
I'm down for the tweaks that they made. If y'all get the game, let's do some Salmon Runs. And the fact that it can be played anytime, like, that's not a literal game changer, but, like, it's something that, honestly, when they said that they were bringing back Salmon Run, I was like, oh yeah, that'll be great. I'll play a lot of that as long as I can play it all the time.
Right.
And thankfully they answered that one thing. And could that have been an update? Sure, but I'm excited for it nonetheless. As far as new stuff, there is Table Turf Battle, this is another thing that I like, that Table Turf Battle Dojo is in Splatsville's vacant lot, which... Woo. I feel like there's a metaphor there. We could have had this open world game. Instead, we just used this parking lot over here and just came up with Gwent. But yeah, it's a 1v1 competitive card battle spinoff of Turf War. Sure, like, I'll be real, I'm not gonna play that no.
it's almost like they challenged themselves to make a new game without touching any of the things in the game. Like, it feels like someone at Nintendo was like, listen, the multiplayer, it's perfect, the single player, it's perfect, Salmon Run, perfect, don't touch any of those, but we do need a new game with some new features. What do you got?
Splash tags,
right?
We've got so splash tags.
They're like, you could decorate your locker, I suppose. Cool.
You could have, and that's the other new thing is you could decorate your locker, which is like, what the what?
Yeah,
It's not a locker that does anything. You just go to a locker room.
You can see the lockers of people after you fight them. Like, maybe there's an audience for Splatoon that is like cheered. There's like footage of like Nintendo World Store or whatever of people just losing their goddamn minds when the lockers announced. But like, that is a neat side thing to do in a game. That is literally like one of five actually new things for Splatoon 3.
Yeah, were you to make a list of top five new features in Splatoon 3, that would have to be on the list.
Yeah, and I do love, and I mean, I did see people excited that like they're making an Inkling, an Octoling, and Small Fry, the amiibo. But like the amiibo effects are unlocked. It'll save favorite gear combinations.
I also already have three Splatoon amiibos.
Yeah, and they come with exclusive gear. Your old stuff's gonna work. I mean, it's neat that they're making amiibo. I probably won't get them. I don't think I got the Pearl and Marina ones. I think I got Callie and Marie. I have like the original ones, Inkling and Octo, and I think there was an Octo one. I don't know. I have a couple of Splatoon amiibo. I'm not gonna get any more.
They should have just made one of like the giant Pikachu amiibo. They should have done one of those, but for big guy.
Arno for Judd, who's not in this. The fucking cat's gone.
Which is upsetting because I recently learned that Judd is over 1,000 years old, according to official Splatoon lore.
Wait, where's... So, I thought Judd was in it. Is Judd not in it?
Did we see him?
I saw Judd, and then small Judd was like kind of spiky in the new game.
Is that a new feature? Spiky Judd.
If you were making a top five list, it would probably have to be in.
Could that have bumped locker decoration out of the top five list?
Oh man, Judd. It is revealed in Splatoon 2 that at some point Judd reactivated the capsule he was cryogenically frozen in to create a clone of himself.
And why isn't that what the single player is about? Why is the single player voids in space when there's a cryogenically frozen cat from 1,000 years ago who carries the knowledge of all mankind? That's canon. So why is the single player what it is when that's canon?
This is, once again, like, this is the shit I actually care about.
Like, yeah,
give me the split. I remember, once again, the fact that like Squid Core is the name of the music, and like that is the music in game canonically. Like, I love that. Why is that just like a joke on the side and not like building out all this lore? Like, we have so many other Nintendo games that are like up to their eyeballs in lore. Like, I'm going through Xenoblade, it's nonsense, and like Splatoon's just like, yeah, we're not going to engage with that. It's there. We probably have a book about it, but we're just, it's just going to be multiplayer. That's it.
And that would be fine if it legitimately was multiplayer. Like, something like Overwatch has just a ton of lore.
Yeah.
But you don't know any of it because it's just a multiplayer game. The problem with Splatoon is that it's a single player game also.
Yeah.
So why, why isn't it anywhere?
I've gone through a lot of emotions over this day.
Yeah.
And I've come to the fact I'm still getting this game. I'll boot up for that demo Splatfest at the end of August. I'm probably going to actually finish Octo Expansion this month. And guess what? I'll probably have a good time with what I play of Splatoon 3. I'll probably have a week or two where I'm really into the multiplayer because it's a good... The concept is very strong.
But yeah.
It is definitely like... I remember how thrilling and exciting it was playing this game in 2015. And sidebar, I was reading some stuff about like... I think there was some Twitter thread of people being like, as you get older, like, does it become harder to wow you in video games? And I'll be real, I don't think it actually, like, I think that I'm more specific in that I want to see something that I haven't seen before. Or if it's something that I'm seeing again, have it be a long time since I haven't seen that thing. And that's what bugs me out of Splatoon 3, is that, you know, a little less than 10 years ago, they came out with this thing that was nothing that I had seen before. It was brilliant. I still think just the idea of Splatoon in how it is a multiplayer game, taking the third person shooter, just the shooter as an online concept, which is well worn into the ground back in 2015, and made it like a relatively nonviolent celebration of just coloring the world around you. And it's the level of approachability that Splatoon has that I love, is that you can play Turf War and you can just basically go around and paint the map by yourself and you're still helping your team. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't need to be constant fighting and engagement. It can just be like, you know, low-level people, low-skilled people playing, and that enjoyment can still be found. That's something that there's a high barrier for entry in a lot of similar games. But I do think over the past decade, I think that high barrier for entry has lowered on those games, and Splatoon hasn't really moved anywhere. Like, I think at this point, technically there's more violence in Fortnite, but if someone were to be like, oh, like, I want to play like a fun casual shooter, don't play Splatoon, don't play Fortnite. Although apparently I think the kids don't like Fortnite anymore. I think it's got an old hat. I don't know. I can't keep up with this shit, but it's just that, like, I think that the gap, that the surprise and shock and awe of Splatoon being this really smart innovation on shooters, I think that gap has kind of widened over the years, because I think other companies have kind of realized that potential, and they're doing a better job at it in some respects than Nintendo is.
Which is in many ways a tale as old as time.
Yeah, but I will be really curious to see how this game sells. We were talking about it a little before the show. Splatoon 1, shockingly, almost made it to 5 million sales on Wii U, which is incredible.
Whoa.
Considering only like 20 Wii U's sold, it's a pretty insane number.
And a third Splatoon, attach rate? I think that's
more than huge. That, because what, they're 13 million-ish Wii U's,
13 I think, point sold. Something.
Yeah, and it's like 4.95 units sold on Wii U. I think it's like the second or third high. I know Mario Kart definitely sold more than it, but Splatoon might actually be like number two. I forget exactly. I don't want to. I might double check that when I get a chance and bring it up when you guys are talking. But Splatoon 2 sold around, I think it's around like 13 million on Switch. And I will be curious how Splatoon 3 does. I think its success in Japan is kind of preordained. Apparently Splatoon 2 is like a top 20 best-selling video game in Japan ever, which I think might be a little bit part of the reason why the sequel is just the same shit over again.
There's a lot of suffering from success with some franchises. Like, Pokemon's the exact same way, where it's like, it sells too well to the point where they can't get away from the formula, because if it's a winning formula, why change it?
They did get away from the formula, and it was awesome.
For a spinoff.
Arceus is mainline.
Yeah, but they're coming out with a new generation in the same year, so like, I hear what you're saying. I don't disagree with you.
That's just the natural quickening of Game Freak's development. Like, they were like, Game Freak was like, we do one a year, but like, we could do more.
Also, I guess you mentioning about them coming out in the same year. I think if there wasn't a pandemic, Arceus came out in 2021. And it probably like, I definitely get the way it looks, but I think there's more of a gap between Arceus and Scarlet Violet if the pandemic doesn't happen.
I can understand that. I can see that.
But anyway, Splatoon 2 sold like, it's like around 13 million. I'm curious if Splatoon 3 is going to top it. I feel like Lifetime crossing 10 million feels like that'll happen. But really, it's going to be an interesting case, because does that, the cynicism that we've been talking about and reveling in, that I know there's other people across the Nintendo world universe that also share our cynicism about Splatoon 3. And I think there's a good number of us, like myself, I'm still going to buy it anyway. But I'm curious if that's going to actually translate to lesser sales. I kind of don't think it will. I think this game is slam dunk going to sell like 10 to 15 million copies.
I mean, isn't it just easily predictable that a second entry, especially one that is as iterative as this one, on the same console will probably sell less?
Yes, you are right. It's also why I'm like academically curious about Xenoblade 3 sales, because is there going to be growth coming from 2017 for some of these franchises? It's actually, I mean, a fascinating sales discussion across the board with seeing how so 2017 for Nintendo, like, huge success across the board. I think Zelda, Odyssey, Splatoon 2, those are three games that like highly outsold. I think Breath of the Wild has outsold the entire rest of the series combined. I think that's bonkers. And like, Odyssey, I believe, is the best-selling mainline Mario game, I think. But it's going to be very interesting to see Nintendo following up on those games, because they're, I mean, they're definitely not going to have the same legs as a Breath of the Wild or Mario Kart, but like, actually, I kind of want to check to see what Splatoon 2 sold after a year, because that might be the most interesting point of reference, because I just think Splatoon 2 definitely had a little bit of growth over, you know, the fact that it's been 5 years since it came out. That Splatoon 3, in 5 years, I would hope to God that Nintendo released a brand new system, or else then, I don't know, Sony and Microsoft are going to be on like Xbox 15 and PlayStation 7, and Nintendo's going to be like, the Switch has a 25-year plan. And I'm not looking forward to that. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
No, I'm about ready for the Switch to... could use an update.
Yeah.
Could use some juice for sure.
But yeah, it is. I mean, it's kind of uncharted territory for Nintendo sales-wise, because most of their... like, I mean, I guess Switch sales did dip a little bit, but I think that might be a little bit more world-related than necessarily Nintendo's fault, although the sales also surged for reasons beyond Nintendo's control, with Animal Crossing just hitting at the perfect time. But I don't think we've had a Nintendo system be this successful for this long, to the point of like Nintendo having a second Zelda during a system's relative peak, a second new 3D Mario, which I hope to God happens within the next year or so. You know, having a Splatoon 3, where I feel like if Splatoon 3 existed, or, you know, in pretty much any time in the past 20 years, Splatoon 3 would probably be on the next system. Yeah. It's just that the Switch has lasted so long.
I guess it kind of seals the deal that the Switch is going to be around for at least the next 2 years, considering Splatoon 3 is going to be supported for 2 years.
That is a fair point. Although backwards compatibility could be a thing.
I mean, I think we still have at least one Switch revision that is still legally a Switch before we move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I think minimum two holidays. I think the absolute earliest we'd see a new system is like 2024.
Like a new system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. I think holiday 2022, holiday 2023 will happen uninterrupted. I think when you get to holiday 2024, that's when I could kind of maybe, and even that, like that, now that I'm saying it out loud, but like, even that's then, a long like, time.
The Switch sales of new Switches are continuing to compete with PS5 and Series X.
Yeah.
Even as those systems become more available.
Yeah, I've seen a number of Series X and Series S's in stores recently, which I would occasionally see one, but now it's basically like every time I go to like a Target or something, I'll just glance and be like, oh wow, if I really wanted to get an S, I could get one now. PS5 I still haven't seen, but I've been hearing anecdotally that PS5s are, yeah, like you might stumble upon one in a store.
Yeah, they're getting better. And I don't think like it's not entirely just that, like, oh, people aren't buying Xboxes, because at least in America, I believe the Series S is the best selling system of that generation. Globally, obviously, the PS5 is crushing it. But of course, nobody knows what an Xbox is in Japan, so that does sort of factor into it. But even with all of that, like, the Switch is competing and oftentimes winning against those systems. So until that stops, I just don't see Nintendo really finding it worth it to do something else. Like, why? Because once you throw something else out there, you're essentially throwing away potential profit you could have made off of this system. So they want to make sure they've gotten everything they can out of it first, I would imagine.
I don't know. I think you want to kind of ride the wave where, like, you don't, yeah, and you want to, like, you don't want to be popping off the new Switch when the original Switch is so dead in the water. Like, yes. I feel like the Wii was really kind of past its prime, and then the Wii U came in and didn't really revive it. Yeah,
you want to be reading trends, but like for you to spot that trend of like, okay, it's time to do the next thing. Like, the system has to start trending down.
True.
Like, whereas right now it has been a pretty flat line for most of the system's lifespan. I think we might have seen some decline in the last year, but that's because video games as a whole had a decline. Realized that outside exists again.
Yeah. That's why, like, Switch sales, every video game company kind of had a rough quarter, just because 2021 was unsustainable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, like, is it really a decline or is it just a recalibration after a pandemic?
Right. A reset back to normalcy. Yeah. 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 Because 2020 was just unlike anything that video games had experienced before. And Nintendo was very well positioned to accidentally take advantage of it through no fault of their own.
So just trying to see. So it took, apparently took Splatoon like almost 3 years to get to 10 million. So I think I'll push back on, I think 10 million is your goal for Splatoon 3.
Yeah.
But here's another thing. Let's play a little game before we get to our next topic. So Splatoon is actually the sixth best selling Wii U game. Number one, Mario Kart 8 at 8.5 million units.
All right.
If you can guess, what are spots 2 through 4 bonus points if you want to try to rank them in order?
Brothers U. New Soup Brothers U. Is probably that, right below Mario Kart 8.
That I will say New Super Mario Brothers U is third.
Okay.
With 5.82.
No.
Mario Maker is right behind Splatoon.
Okay.
4 million.
So it's number 7.
And I will say for New Super Mario Brothers U, New Super Luigi U actually counts as a different game and sold 3 million. So technically New Super Mario Brothers U is probably top dog, but I think that's separate sales for New Super Luigi U.
So Mario Maker is outside.
Yes. Of this Mario okay. Maker is 7th. It's right below Splatoon. So
what's left?
So 2, 4, and 5. 3D World is 2. 5.88. Okay. 3 and 4. I'll give hints.
Did Breath of the Wild do that well on Wii U to be in that?
I will answer your question no.
Okay. Game & Wario?
That's
absolutely
a one.
Game & Wario? I will say, my son has been playing Game & Wario. Game & Wario is pretty fun.
Based on how hard it is to find a copy, I have to assume that Devil's Third is in the top 5.
No, because I think they only made 1,000 copies.
That's tragic.
All right, do you want
Tropical
hints?
Freeze? Was Tropical Freeze
absolutely not?
Okay,
should
Tropical
be.
Freeze, I think, barely made 1 million or something. It didn't do that great on Wii U.
Not Pikmin. Is it Pikmin?
Nope.
Okay,
nope.
We've named all the Wii U games.
All right, there is a launch game and a holiday 2014 game.
Surely Nintendo Land count?
So Nintendo Land, I think, benefits from being a bundle in some versions. That had 5.21 million. That's the fifth one. We are missing
a bundle game sell worse than Mario Kart?
Yes. Well, I believe with Nintendo Land, it wasn't bundled in. Like, I think there were the two different Wii U's.
Right.
I think
there was a white version with 8 gigabytes and no Nintendo
Land.
Yeah,
I had to buy my copy of Nintendo Land separately. And it also, they stopped bundling it and started bundling other games on the
but definitely Nintendo Land got a boost because if you think like probably half of Nintendo Land sales comes from bundles.
So we're still missing one?
We're still missing
the other one
fourth.
A Wii game, like the Wii Fit Plus or like Wii Fit U or
no.
Wii Sports Club.
Wii is in the title though.
Wii's in the title.
Yes.
Wii Party U?
2014 holiday game.
I don't remember dates, but it's not Wii Fit U. It's
Smash Brothers.
Yeah, it's Smash Brothers. It's Super Smash Brothers for the Wii U.
Oh, right. Okay, I forget that people like that garbage game.
It's a good game.
Okay.
I just like, it's so weird thinking back to that about how like the 3DS version came out like 1.5 months before and was slightly different.
It was
like, what a weird time. I enjoyed the 3DS version way more than the Wii U version.
The 3DS version I played in constant fear of breaking my 3DS.
No, it absolutely destroyed those the little thumb grip things.
The 3DS was not made to play Smash Bros.
Yeah, they should have made an adapter for a GameCube controller that you could connect to your 3DS because that's how you're supposed to play it.
Well, adapter, you can connect it to your Circle Pad Pro. So you attach the Circle Pad Pro and then you attach the GameCube Pro.
I remember having a blast playing it on because I think new 3DS came out early 2015. I remember playing a bunch of Smash Brothers on new 3DS.
No, you should have plugged it into your Amiibo NFC thing pedestal. Did you guys ever have the pedestal?
Yeah. No, I have. I mean, keep in mind, I did do a lot of writing for a Nintendo website during that era. So yeah. I think I have like three different docs for the 3DS. I've got like, I think I have a CirclePad Pro. Did they make a CirclePad Pro for the XL? Yes.
They sure did.
I have that as well. I do remember for the Kid Icarus Uprising tournament at a PAX East, I brought my CirclePad Pro because they had you like playing. I forget if you used your own system or not, but I brought my CirclePad Pro so I can play it left-handed.
Yeah, the left-handed tax was real on the 3DS.
All right, so let's talk a little bit before we get dive into our Xenoblade hole, which I will be doing after we're done recording anyway. So the Dio Field Chronicle is coming out in September on Switch, and a free demo that I think it's like the first couple hours of the game, and
it's the entirety of the first chapter.
Okay. I think I heard like 2 to 3 hours of gameplay or something. Seems fair. Save data carries over. But John, I think you've played it more than me. I've played about half an hour, 40 minutes. I think I am intrigued. It is not exactly what I expected. I expected a little bit more of a Fire Emblem game where it does feel, and this is partially because the music is coming from Game of Thrones guys.
Oh, is it? Okay, cool.
It gives me a vibe of more I feel like as far as like the tenor of the story is a little bit more Thronesy than Fire Emblem-y, if that makes sense.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
And the real, like, I knew that like there was some kind of like I think they called it like it's like the real-time battle, active battle system or something like that. They gave it some Square Enix name. I didn't expect it to just be an RTS.
Yes. Yeah, and that was something like, so I started playing this and get into the combat, and I'm like, oh wait, like this is literally just an RTS. Like no city building or anything, but like a combat driven RTS. And I went on Slack because I was like, maybe I just missed like all of the marketing for this, but I definitely felt like this was pitched as a tactics game with real-time elements.
There was like a weird way that they were phrasing it.
Yeah, and I guess I like just misunderstood what they meant
or something.
Yeah, which I think in my mind just meant like, oh, maybe like everybody's turn kind of takes place at the same time or something. Like I didn't really understand what they meant. But now, yeah, I'm playing it and I'm like, why? Like, does Square Enix think they invented real-time strategy games? Because that's all you did.
The quote, real-time tactical battle system.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's like open zone, you know, like, okay, yeah. So you made an open world game.
Although I will say, like, it is a very clever, because Square Enix back in like the 90s had the active time battle system, which, you know, is awesome and a foundation for a lot of classic RPGs. But I do love the cheekiness of them like using that same dumb naming scheme for this and acting like they invented it.
Yeah, it's not an RTS, it's an RTTBS.
Yeah.
Totally different.
It's a real time tactical bullshit.
Yeah. But that being said, I think I like it. It's
can you use the touchscreen?
I haven't tried, but it's not a very fast-paced game. Like it's real time, but I'm never finding myself where I'm like, "Oh, I can't get to this unit in time." And you're pretty much, at least so far for me, I've never been in a situation like I've done I think 4 battles and your party seems to be limited to 4 active members. So you're not controlling that much, at least where I'm at right now. Things might get crazier later in the game. So it's pretty easy to manage everyone. And pretty much anytime you like select a character and go to move them, like the action kind of goes into slow motion while you're navigating.
Yeah.
So it's
pretty gentle in that regard.
Yeah. I will say a rare sight for Switch is that this feels like a game that maybe when they started development, they knew they were going to make a Switch version. It actually looks pretty nice on Switch, runs at a pretty high, like maybe 720 or 900p, runs smoothly.
Looks nice on the OLED.
Looks nice on the OLED, but also looks nice on your TV.
I don't believe the touchscreen is in use. I might have just picked up my Switch and tested to see if the touchscreen. I don't think the touchscreen is usable, but I'm not in a battle right now.
Unfortunate.
But I do think the controls, like, they kind of remind me, it's been a very long time since I played, like, Civ Rev on 360,
yeah.
But it is not as complex as Civ Rev, But it feels in that, like, just the snappiness of, like, oh, like, here you do waypoints by, like, okay, I'm going to select to walk and then, like, hit a button to, like, have this be a point in the yep. like, the walking path. Like, it's pretty intuitive, pretty snappy, and I haven't felt like I've been fumbling for buttons, which I feel like I have in crappy console RTSs.
Are these small maps or big maps? What's the scale we're working with here?
It depends. Some of them you can almost fit on a single screen, especially if you're kind of zoomed out. But there are other ones that almost feel like a dungeon crawler. Okay. Like, I've done a few where, like, you're going through what is very much a level as opposed to, like, an open arena. Like, kind of going through rooms and, like, finding buttons to open doors and, like, lowering drawbridges and things like that. So it really depends on the match. Some of them are definitely like, here is an open battlefield. And some of them are like, you need to infiltrate this enemy fortress. And so you just start on one side. You're working your way through like very planned out encounters.
And are you micromanaging like different skirmishes and smaller groups across a map? Or are they all kind of together?
They're all like you have four party members. And at least so far, it's all like hero characters. Like it's
no generics.
I say so far because I'm pretty sure I saw in some trailers that there was some squad based units, so I'm assuming maybe that's something that happens later, but right now it's all single units. I am at a point where I have more party members available than I can bring on at once, so I can assign like a secondary party member to be a backup to an existing one, which means like they get less XP, but I can use that party member's ability with the primary one. But it still only shows one of them on the map when you're moving around. But it's pretty easy to manage. And most of the time, like there are certain scenarios where it might be good to split up your party, but most of the time you're going to have your party in pretty close proximity to each other. Cause it does sort of feel like almost RTS, but with a hint of like a Diablo style game as far as like how level progression kind of feels. But then between levels,
so you're like in League of Legends?
Maybe. No, maybe. I get what you mean.
Are you going to beat Matt in Mario Party and make him play this game?
I don't know. Sometimes when you say stuff, it sounds good, and I don't want Matt to play a good game.
That's fair. But when you're between battles, that's when it's honestly most like Fire Emblem, where it's just you're in third person, you're wandering around this fortress or whatever that you're based at, and you can talk to the other people there, and there's like shops and places where you can upgrade your gear, and that feels pretty directly inspired by Three Houses.
Yeah. It's like the worst part of Fire Emblem Three Houses. They brought that
yes,
in.
Yes, there's listen, the major problem I've had with Diofield Chronicles so far is that like there aren't nearly enough young students for you to groom as their teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Which really lets down the experience, I think. But you know, some people may like that. No.
Okay. because of the lack of child soldiers to groom, that's why it's right. a worse story.
No,
okay.
The story yeah. seems the story itself is fine. And I assume that maybe as the game goes on, the stories or the characters will get more interesting. Right now, all of the characters just have the character trait of being kind of British. the character models, while good, are hilariously not emotive at all. Like their mouth just sort of wiggles and that's it. And most of the time they're not making eye contact with each other.
Oh yeah. When you like go talk to them, do they like pivot in place instead of like,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Love that.
There are some nice character portraits that show up during dialogue, which is nice. The cutscenes, like the more complex cutscenes are all pre-rendered, but they definitely look like they're pre-rendered from a real-time cutscene.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder, I need to download the Xbox or PlayStation version of this and see if those cutscenes are actually real time on the other systems. Because there's little, you know, things that you excuse in real time graphics that you wouldn't see in pre-rendered graphics that are happening in these cutscenes that I have to believe that they are being rendered in a more capable version of this engine than is running on the Switch, as opposed to in a separate animation tool.
It's just part of the genre. It's real-time tactics, real-time cutscenes.
Yes, real-time pre-rendered cutscenes. I was telling Neil it's like playing Call of Duty 3 on the Wii back in 2006, where you'd go from Wii graphics and then you'd get to a cutscene and it would suddenly switch to a recording of the Xbox 360 version.
Nice.
But yeah, no, I am interested. I kind of downloaded this more just to, you know, participate in talking about it. I am enjoying it more than I expected to. I don't know if I could survive an entire game of it unless the story gets like way more interesting.
Right.
But I conceptually like what they're doing, and I appreciate that it actually feels like a game that they maybe designed with Switch in mind and then upgraded to the other systems, as opposed to what we usually see on Switch, which is that it's a crazy downgrade of the other systems. So, and a nice change of pace there.
Yeah, I'm excited to try the demo whenever I get over my Xenoblade, I don't know, binge, I guess we'll call it.
Yeah, just go straight into 3 or hook up the Wii U and play X, you know.
Yeah, well, I said yesterday, oh, I'll play Dio Field when I get back home. I got back home and I played more Xenoblade.
That's, yeah, welcome.
Yep, but it does sound good. Like anything that seems even like slightly inspired by Fire Emblem, I'm going to take a look at.
Yeah, I'll be interested. I feel like the comparisons to Fire Emblem were so prevalent with this game that I'm going to be interested to see more of like how people who are coming to it from that perspective react to it. Because from a combat perspective, it's absolutely nothing like Fire Emblem. So, yeah, I'll be interested to see what people think of it. And if suddenly everybody starts... just all the Fire Emblem fans start wanting real-time strategy games, that'll be great because I can start suggesting real-time strategy games to people. That'd be exciting.
The Lord of the Rings, The Battle for Middle Earth 2 is super good.
That's hell the yeah. one. No, if I can get some people to play Age of Empires 2 with me, that'd be...
That's there's too much that'd construction. Nice. There's too... Like, what I love about Lord of the Rings, Battle for Middle Earth 2 is that it has the Howard Shore soundtrack from the movies. And it just like it's very combat focused.
It's not really much of a city. See, I need the city builder element of it.
Really? That part's always been like that's just taking up so much time. I just want to go fight some orcs.
I haven't played a game of Civ in a very, very long time. I should play that Switch version. It was okay.
Yeah.
Turn based, but you know, it's in the family.
Yeah, I guess. You're right. Turn based. My bad. I just a lot of their strategy.
It gets lumped in with.
I feel like
Age of Empires and StarCraft and all that stuff.
There's good PC strategy games, whether turn based or real time. Kind of, you know, there's a cosmic gumbo sort.
Yeah, and Age of Empires is also like you are, training up a civilization.
Yeah.
Through time, it's very Civ-like.
It's just like it's more of a micro focus as opposed to a big macro Civ focus.
Well, that's gonna do it for the main show. Right into connectivity@nintendoreport.com.
Especially if you if you have opinions on Splatoon that may convince us why you're excited for Splatoon 3.
Yeah. That's tell what us I want about your email why you're excited about Splatoon 3, or what allergies you have that Mario Kart treats might kill you. if you played the Dio Field demo, by all means, share your thoughts. Just, tell us how you're doing. We care. Connectivity@NintendoReport.com. That's the email. You can also hit us up on Twitter @ConnectivityNWR. And that's going to do it for this main portion. Stay tuned after the credits for some hot Xenoblade 1 spoilers. And I mean, maybe a little bit early spoilers on the break.
This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.
And we're back.
Xenoblade.
Holy shit, Xenoblade 3 is good.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear that because Xenoblade 1 is incredible and 2 sucks.
I do think the one thing in 1 that, as we'll probably talk about, I think the story in 1 is better, but I don't think that's not to say the story in 3 is bad. I think some of the presentation of the story in 3 is too long-winded, but I also do love, like, so just a kind of general thing about it is that, like, those that seventh hero member, like, there are basically like side quests to get those characters, and I peeked a little bit that there's also like quests to like increase the rank that are, most of them seem to be optional outside of a couple that are kind of main story. And it's just incredible how much like good characterization and like unique takes of the theme are hidden in side content, but it's side content that isn't gacha based.
Yep. And it kind of, well, okay. I feel like honestly that may have been what Xenoblade 2 could have been if they hadn't needed to finish it by 2017. Because there was some of that in Xenoblade 2, and then it feels like they were like, well, we ran out of time to write quests. So random. Yep. But then I did want to make the comment as far as like story goes that I was talking to Matt, and I was talking to somebody at work about this, that the problem with comparing Xenoblade 1's story, which we'll get into with Alex in a second, to literally anything else in another Xenoblade game or in any other video game is that I kind of feel like Xenoblade 1 is like up there as far as just works of fiction for the human race. So like anything else just sort of feel like yes, Xenoblade 3's story isn't quite as good as Xenoblade 1, but like that's fine. Like it's an insanely high bar for a video game story.
What do you think about the party? Like the characters within your group, are they well realized? And 3,
something that in the interviews that they had up on Nintendo's website, they kind of talked about like trying to balance the 6 characters, even though like Noah and Mio are kind of the core protagonists in a way. And I don't think that's bullshit. I think they actually do a good job of kind of giving each character their moment in the sun in different times. And I think they all have distinct personalities that come out, and like there's arguments amongst the team. Although that being said, like, I mean, like, fucking Shulk rules. Like I like his arc is great, and the characters around him are mostly very good. I kind of reserve the right to change my mind about it as I get deeper into it, but just my guess is like I think I am partial to the cast of Xenoblade 1 just because I think I think they all kind of fit a role in that story. And while some of them are maybe not as core to it as others, I think like that game works very well just because of the variety that everybody kind of brings to the table. Plot wise, maybe not necessarily character wise. Cause that's another thing is I think the combat in 3 just clowns on 1, which makes sense since they've had a decade plus to iterate on that combat style. And I think that the combat in 1 is probably the worst part of it compared to all the subsequent games.
Yeah, I think even 2 makes some significant improvements on 1's combat.
Yeah, that's one thing is that like I might moan and groan about like the gacha system with the blades and all that shit, but like the actual like when you were in battle in 2, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to throw out for anybody who loves 2 who feels like we're bashing on it, I also love Xenoblade 2.
I don't.
I'm just aware that it has some problems, but I hear you, and I also love it, and it's okay that you like it.
It's got pretty music.
It's got fantastic music.
Yeah, it is very good music.
But Alex, you fucking did it.
I did it. Major spoilers beyond this point.
Yeah. Yeah, go nuts.
I beat the game. Any other like oh shit moment as like as big as just landmark Saturn?
Oh my goodness! I have loved what. So Alex has been just in Slack giving us these little messages, which have been my hints as to where he's at in the game. And it's been so great to just get those and be like, fuck, I know exactly where he is. And yeah, yeah. It's just so. Yeah. From essentially like from the moment that Dixon shoots Shulk and then Zanza pops out, the rest of that game is just like, what the fuck is happening?
It's wild. It's bizarre what happens. Well,
what's crazy is that it remains coherent the yes. entire time. Like it never becomes some weird Kingdom Hearts, I have no idea what's going on anime bullshit.
Right. Like, it's thematically consistent too.
Right. It completely makes sense the entire time that it's doing absolutely insane things. And I think that's something that very few JRPGs that try to do something to this level manage to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. No, it's at the end becomes about fate and changing the future, which is something that was Shulk has been doing the entire time up until Eggle. But it becomes like his goal is to unshackle the world from the horrible fate that has been determined by this evil god. And even though it becomes bizarre and you're like walking around the solar system, our solar system, which I mean, are Shulk and his friends like cosmically huge, even though they are tiny on the Bionis, but they're walking around space like they're well, enormous.
We know from Xenoblade 2, because canonically Shulk has met Rex in Xenoblade 2 via some DLC. And we know that they were roughly the same size.
Okay.
And we know that Rex is proportional to an Earth human in size. So I think they are technically, unless coming through into Rex's dimension, altered their scale. Maybe the Xenoblade 3 DLC will solve this question once and for all.
Also, side note, but like, did Takahashi work on Final Fantasy VII?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so much Final Fantasy VII.
Well,
but I don't think he was as happy about it.
So I think he got pulled. Oh, I'm going to get this wrong. Go watch the Good Vibe Gaming video. But I believe what happened was that he was working on Final Fantasy VII, got pulled.
Wasn't Xenogears supposed to be like an idea for Final Fantasy?
It was pitched as one of the possibilities for Final Fantasy VII. And I love that Square Enix's reason for not doing it was they thought it was too complicated.
I mean, they weren't wrong.
I just love the idea that like there's like they have a limit for how weird Final Fantasy can be.
He worked on concept art for Final Fantasy VII.
Okay.
And I think it was the kind of thing that he was working on Final Fantasy VII. And I know he went from Final Fantasy VII directly to working on Xenogears.
I think he may have spent some time on what would become Chrono Cross at some point in there, but I don't know where that landed.
Maybe because there was, because I know there was stuff
all
about
all that stuff was happening at like the same time.
I believe like, what happened is that I think. Because after Chrono Trigger, there was kind of no one wanted to. This is where it gets into my expertise of Masato Kato, is that after Chrono Trigger, like because Sakaguchi and Yuji Horii, like that Dream Team, kind of split up and went their separate ways. But there was desire at Square to make a follow up to it, and Radical Dreamers wind up coming from that because Kato got the green light to do something for Satellaview. I think that was made in like 4 months or whatever, and then follows up specifically his stuff. And then I think they were kind of being like, what's the Chrono Trigger 2 going to be? And I think Takahashi might have worked on some kind of concept for that. But I don't think any of that really came. Because Chrono Cross was basically, that was all Masato Kato, from what I know.
Yeah. And I think that may have been between his time on 7 and his time on Xenogears, but that could be wrong. But I guess, yes, in answer to your question, he was tangentially related to Final Fantasy 7.
Yeah, because there's just a whole lot of Final Fantasy VII ideas. I'm not sure if all of them are influences or if they're just like parallel ideas that maybe were arrived to independently. But stuff like just like the Telethia looks like Safer Sephiroth. And even like Zanza's final form also looks like Safer Sephiroth. And also the supernova is going through the solar system. ether and life force are similar ideas.
I think some of that just comes from Final Fantasy games in general. Because he did...
He does have a history in that series. Yeah,
I mean, that's what I brought up. I brought up his credits, and it's kind of funny. From 1998 to today, at least from this list, he has, you know, like a dozen game credits at least. Only one of them does not have Zeno in the title. Somabringer. I think the Nintendo published Japanese-only game that came out on DS. One of Monolith's first projects when they were owned by Nintendo. But... yeah, like he did battle graphics for Final Fantasy IV, field graphics for Final Fantasy V, and he was like the graphic director is his title of Final Fantasy VI. I know he designed the magic tech armor that is in the opening cutscene of Final Fantasy VI, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of, because you mentioned like how some of the anime, like the final bosses and stuff look, like that's also a thing that happens in earlier Final Fantasy games, like VI with like Kefka's final form. Is similarly ridiculous looking.
Yeah. The sort of like amorphous, angelic, godlike hellspawn demon thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Final Fantasy VI was where we found out that he really likes mechs.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite little bits from the Good Vibe Gaming video was him. They talked about an interview with him where he essentially was talking about how Xenoblade X was like the game that he had wanted to make when he was making Xenogears, where he's just like, I just want to make a game with giant robots.
Which I thought was cute. Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to keep you guys too long, but I do have a couple lore questions for you.
Okay.
I will listen.
What is Shulk? Was he ever alive?
Even so, I know that one.
Yeah,
he was a child, and then he goes to the Monado. He dies. The Monado eats up a bunch of the ether from the Homs.
Doesn't die. So his family was in this like expeditionary team in the Valak Mountains. It kills everyone but him, and then Zanza essentially is like dormant within him, and it's just sort of this voice within his head for his entire life.
I thought. At some point, it like says like there never was a Shulk. I think Zanza
has
that line.
That's what Zanza says. Like, I think it, like Zanza kind of has like it's not technically true. Like Zanza essentially is saying like it's like I am who this kid was. I'm why he managed to do everything he did. There is no Shulk as an individual. It's always been me. But then Shulk's arc after that is kind of him discovering that like. Like, no, he was still a part of that process. Like, Zanza was always there, but, like, Shulk was always Shulk.
Yeah, he was reclaiming his identity, almost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who is the second consort of the Hyentia?
Oh, God. So, you never see her on screen, but the second consort... So, the Hyentia...
Melia's mom.
Yeah, the Hyentia Emperor takes two mates. Mm-hmm. One that's Hyentia and one that's Homs, specifically so that, because I guess he knows about the whole Hyentia turning into Telethia thing. And yeah, he takes a Homs consort and has a child with them so that there is a line, a Hyentia royal line that is gradually becoming less and less Hyentia, so that when the cycle of destruction starts, they will not become Hyentia. But you never see the second consort on screen. What's extra weird is that, like, Kallian is the son of the first consort, who is Hyentia, but then Tyria is Kallian's half-sister, who is the daughter of the first consort and a different Homs that is unrelated to any of the others. So the Antiqua family tree has a lot of branches in various directions and to various species.
And we don't ever get any clue as to who the mother of Melia is.
No, they may talk about her in like side quest dialogue, but you never see her. I don't think you ever really get any real details as to who she is.
That seems like a bit of a, I don't know, like a missed opportunity, because it seems like the Homs versus Hyentia bloodline seems to be like a central Melia
yeah,
character arc. It's very integral to her character, and it seems like they kind of missed out on the opportunity of having that conflict realized by having her actual mom in the game. Yeah.
I almost wonder if they were working on that section of the game and realized that it was going on for many, many hours. Mm-hmm. and we're just
true.
Like, you have,
heresy is,
like, you
is
have to stop. Because, yeah. that whole segment is long, and there's a lot of lore dump in it. Mm-hmm. So it would make sense to me if there was cut stuff there. Because, yeah, it does feel, it is an odd thing to just totally leave out. There is, it's like, as far as her not appearing, I don't remember how much the game talks about it, but the High Entia have like a really long lifespan. So,
oh, she probably died.
Yeah, it's possible that she may not even still be alive. Like, I don't know if they ever specifically say how old Melia is. But I think she's older than she looks, I believe, is the implication.
Yeah. Still got the hots for Shulk, though.
Everybody does. That is a Xenoblade trope that will show back up in 2. The good old friend zone character.
Yeah. I guess speaking of like love interests, like it's Fiora, did she seem like she like lost her characterization after she became a robot to you all?
Not personally.
It's been a while. Like, I don't remember having that feeling, but I also haven't been at that part of the game since like 2015.
I remember like a lot more like ribbing between Fiora and Rein and Shulk. And after she becomes a robot, she kind of loses that, which makes her a little bit more cold.
I think there's an element maybe of like, the tone in which you are seeing her is very different. Like when we're
it
seeing
seem
her
to
at
come
the beginning
back in the very last scene a little bit with like the haircut comment.
Yeah, like it because when you know when we're seeing at the beginning, like everything's fine. And then when you see her again, like she's been through just insane amounts of trauma. And like everything's gone to shit. And so yeah, there's a shift in her personality, but I think it's kind of justified by where she's at in the story.
Yeah. Because that was one thing. I kind of got like Wind Waker flashbacks to Tetra turning into Zelda. It's like,
sure.
Oh, your personality is gone. That sucks.
Yeah.
But man, that game is so good. The plot is incredible. I mentioned this in the Slack, but it plays, especially when you play in casual mode, it plays kind of like a really, really good fantasy novel where it plants things and answers questions and pays off those plants while also bringing up new questions at a very, very good pace where it just kind of smoothly brings you along and into the next scene where you'll probably get a great big revelation, but also a new question to try and figure out.
Yeah, if you haven't watched Matt's storytelling video on it yet, like obviously what everybody took from that video is issues with Xenoblade 2, but like the other half of that video is about how Xenoblade 1 just fucking nails it and is very much worth watching for that perspective as well.
Yep, I'm very happy with my experience with Xenoblade 1. I think we've already touched on the combat, but the combat kind of is take it or leave it. It's fine, but if I wasn't playing on casual mode, I think I would get sick of it. The lack of ability to switch to a different party member and like control when I get my buffs or try and debuff the enemy, because it feels
you're gonna
like
love three.
Yes.
Oh my god.
I'm very excited
it's
for three.
It's incredible, man.
Because it was like, okay, so I'm either gonna have to play as a buff debuff or healer, some sort of support character that's gonna be able to manage all that, or play as a tank or play as the damage and like just hope that the AI is gonna do the right thing. And on casual mode, doesn't really matter. I just basically had Shulk, Rein, and Dunban the entire time, just chain leaking a ton of damage. And that works just fine in casual mode. You don't really need a healer. But yeah, it's a very, very good video game.
I'm glad that you've had this reaction to it, because it is one of those games where I'm like, like I play it and I'm like, this is one of the most incredible games I've ever played in my entire life. But whenever there's a game like that and you try to like get somebody else to play it, there's always that vibe of like they're, it's not going to click for them like it clicked for me. So it's, I love anytime somebody else finishes it and has that exact same reaction of like getting to the end and just be like, holy shit. Like what the fuck just happened? That was incredible.
It makes me really want to just romp through a casual playthrough of it, because I feel like when we were even talking about the beginning of the game, when you were starting, or, you know, just 7 days ago when you were 75 hours earlier in the game.
It
reminded me a lot of how I felt when playing the Definitive Edition, where I'm like, oh, like there's a lot of empty space and like there's parts of this that I don't know about. But it's great to hear that like the story just still slaps.
It lands, it wins out so well. And I think looking back on it, like the scale is like, it's ridiculous. And I'm not sure why they need to go that far, but it also kind of makes sense because it sells the idea that you're on these giant titans.
It serves the story in a way.
Yeah. And if it was like Final Fantasy 13, where it's just literal hallways and it's like all the stuff around you is just like window dressing, it wouldn't have sold that idea as much, I think. Whereas when you do have to literal like walk through these giant planes, or you're inside of the Bionis is like, their circulatory system?
Oh yeah, where there's like blood cells floating through the air, and really,
like I'm smaller than a blood cell.
That
was a great moment too. It does sell the idea of the size and the scale, even though you don't. The way that I played it, it was like as a lot narrower than it looked.
I do think there's value in the game pointing out to you that you are tiny and insignificant in a game that's ultimately about going from that to literally being God.
Yes.
I like there's that journey of like, I am nothing in comparison to, like, you look at the Bionis and you're like, okay, that's a God. And then by the end of the game, you're like, no, I'm that. Like, so that's, I think that's a cool thematic evolution that you get over the course of the game.
Do we have any more information about the giants?
Fuck no.
Okay.
They do. They're kind of referenced in Future Connected. Like, you'll hear mention of them in like some environmental detail, but like nothing about what or why. Maybe someday. But yeah, there's hilariously little detail about them.
Is there any information about why there are colonies 6 and 9, but no other numbered colonies?
I assume that they were destroyed the Mekon.
Yeah, that was always my assumption too.
Yeah, because they say like, oh, the only Homs settlements are just 6 and 9. That's all that remains now. It's like almost somewhat post-apocalyptic.
I like to think
69,
that,
dude.
Exactly. I like to think that somebody asked Takahashi what the colonies were called,
and he snickered
and then wrote 69.
It was the beginning of the going up the Atlas line.
Yeah, he's like, the next game's gonna have boobs.
Yeah,
takes big hit off of Bong.
And the initial outline for Xenoblade 3 is like, and then it ends with this dude going down, and like Nintendo's just like, yo, bro, no,
you've got to stop.
Yeah, what if this guy wears a dress with a boob window on it? Okay, that's fine. I've got that one.
You have that? Okay.
Yeah, I have. That's four heroes now. Well, technically, I have four. Like, whatchamacallit isn't there now.
Yeah. I was talking to Matt about that. I'm like they really kind of texture some of the boob shaping into the outfits.
It's
like
funny.
Texture work. And so then when you put it on a male character, it looks hilarious.
Yep.
But, you know, yeah, I guess it saved time. Friggin' lazy Nintendo.
So I have, and I feel like this is something to just keep on the show too. Chain Attacks, Xenoblade 3. I know, like, that, I mean, that's been in the series before, but, like, I don't know what the differences are or even what the optimal, there was a while where I was just trying to see how long I could make them last, so I would be trying to barely get over 100%, but I've noticed that it seems like you want to shatter 100%.
You either want to get like right at it or clear 150 at least.
Okay.
Because at 150, you'll get a second person back.
Oh, okay.
So you don't want to land like 140 is just a waste of your time.
Yeah.
So yeah, you either want to go and like if you use the healers, like they can't break 100. So like you kind of want to.
You can kind of set yourself up.
Yeah.
Is it like in one where you use like the same colored abilities in order to break up the chain?
It makes way more. I've played through one several times now, and I still don't totally have a good grip on the chain attack system in one. Three makes a lot more sense of essentially you're filling up a gauge up to like at 100%, you'll do this big finishing move. But you can only use each character once as you go through the chain. But depending on how big your finishing move is, you'll get some of them back for the next round. And then you can keep going until you run out of characters. And so it's all about like managing them so that you can get a really high percentage so that you can keep the chain attack going for longer. And as you go into the game, they'll add new things into it that I won't spoil. But it makes a bit more sense. Xenoblade 2's chain attacks were honestly pretty cool because with those, you would, depending on what you did, you would get certain like elemental damages going. And then the goal in that was to see how long you could keep it going so you could build up as many different elements as you could. And then at the end, you could burst all of those elements and just do batshit insane amounts of damage, which was essentially the only way to kill the final boss unless you were insanely overleveled. But it was a good chain attack system.
And then last chain attack question. I haven't figured out exactly. So like when it like ends after I do three or four, is there like rhyme or reason or.
I think some of that gets extended as you go.
OK, that makes sense. Because I know
there's
aspects of it that are kind of referenced that I haven't unlocked yet. Because I'm 25 hours into the game and there's still more tutorials.
Yep.
I love it. It's so good. Like I really, so far, this is like the best outcome for what I expected out of this game. It's really neat.
Well, and at 25 hours in, you're now at the point where I expected you to quit.
Yeah. So. No, I'm at the point where I think I was like ready to throw my Switch out a window when I was in the hospital with my preemie son.
yeah.
Because that was the last time that I played that, which was when, it's when I gave Octopath a 9 out of 10 instead of an 8 out of 10. It was my most lenient, and I still Xenoblade 2. Nope.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
It should only take you like a day to do Future Connected, Alex. So.
Nice. And then I'll jump into 3. Sweet.
Yeah, Future Connected is very short.
I'm going to throw this out there into the ether, because I think Xenoblade 1 is an incredible game, but I'm not sure if I'll play it on Definitive Edition. I think it deserves like a full-up remake of some sort that kind of tweaks the combat system. Probably not, but I just want that idea to be in the universe somewhere.
I mean, not for a long time, but
yeah,
it is.
I'll be happy if it comes out like 10 years. In 10 years from now, it is
a highly enough regarded game that I would not be surprised to see it make more appearances on other
especially platforms. Because I think Xenoblade 2's problems are so numerous, but with Xenoblade X 2 and 3, I'd say to a lesser extent X, like I think that how those games came out, it's pretty easy to just be like, oh, we're gonna lift this and bring it to a new platform. I think
if you put the Switch versions of 1, 2, or 3 onto a more powerful system, you would essentially get another round of remasters.
That is true.
Because most of those games run at 540p.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I also think that with 1, the combat kind of stands out, but that would need a much more fuller remake. Which, hey.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get Xenoblade Chronicles FF7 remake style.
I would love that, honestly.
Yeah.
But,
I don't know. Right. I kind of like the giant bar of arts, even though I think it probably is objectively worse.
It's so inefficient.
Yes, yeah, but there's a meta game to like being like, all right, this art needs to be next to this art because I'm always going to use it after I use this one.
Yeah,
laying out your arts bar.
I did do that.
Yep. It is like it's definitely thinking about the Xenoblade 1 combat system, I'm like, after playing 3, but there is a charm to how that battle system works.
I have no trouble going back to it. I think it's, they've improved on it, but I think it was pretty good.
I have a feeling it will be a long time before I do, and I think I'd rather go replay X before I go back to 1, but I think a casual romp through 1 is in my future.
It's worth it.
All right. I think we should end the show, guys.
That's the second ending of the show. Ending B.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.